Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst, I'll be your host for the next hour. Thanks for joining me. We are talking about Spotify today, and I am really excited to share this interview with you. We're going to be talking with Liz Pelley, and we are discussing Liz's new book, Mood Machine, The Rise of Spotify and the Costs of the Perfect Playlist. Liz has covered Spotify in The Baffler and in several pieces over the last several years, and she brings it all together in this book, Mood Machine. Spotify is a really important topic for anyone who listens to music, listens to radio, listens to streaming, and friends, this is the book. I recommend this book. If you have any interest in understanding Spotify, and even I would say the lessons in this book apply beyond Spotify to reveal how other tech giants work and some of the tricks that they use in building their business model. I'm going to go ahead and play this interview for you because, as I said, I'm very eager to share it with you. If you want links to Liz's book, Mood Machine, and other things that I may discuss at the end of the show, go to the playlist, which is at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, and click the playlist link for the Liz Pelley episode. Let's go ahead and now listen to my interview with Liz Pelley here on Tectonic. Liz Pelley, welcome to Tectonic.
Hey, Mark. Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. I'm so happy to talk with you about your new book, Mood Machine, The Rise of Spotify and the Costs of the Perfect Playlist, as published by Simon & Schuster. I found this to be an invaluable guide to how Spotify is changing the music industry, primarily for its own benefit. I thought we would start with the role that Spotify plays in the music industry, because I suspect that a lot of people think of Spotify as a kind of scrappy startup, somehow independent of giant corporations. You write near the beginning of the book that Spotify is, quote, a functional impossibility without the participation of the major label oligopoly of Universal, Sony, and Warner. Liz, can you describe why those three major labels are so important to Spotify?
Sure. So I think one way of thinking about it is if you think about what Spotify is, what it offers to its average user, you know, it's an app that you can open and presumably you can search for any song in the world and hit play and it'll start streaming. I mean, people who are really into music know that these services don't actually have every song in the world. There's actually a lot of material that's missing. But if you think of like, whatever, you know, the average music listener, whatever that means, it's also kind of like a dubious concept because people are so, you know, weird and different. But the idea of a service that you could open and search for basically any song from across the history of popular recorded music and actually turn up a result and hit play in order to create that product requires that the major labels that sit on the rights to so much of what we think of when we think of the history of popular recorded music, it requires their participation because they have to license that content. And again, also would never use the word content if it wasn't the way these services were actually thinking about what they do. But it's a word that I always feel like I need to qualify because it is one that I don't really like using as a shorthand for music, but it's how they think of it. Anyway, so the major labels have to license their material to the services. And because they sit on such a large percentage of recorded music, they have this really outsized negotiating power. So it means when it comes time to sign deals, they're able to ask for things that a small independent or DIY label wouldn't be able to ask for. And when a streaming service like Spotify, for example, was starting, first launching, that meant that in those initial negotiations, they were able to get things like enormous advances, equity in the company, free advertising, influence over how the platform evolved, per user minimum payments on certain tiers of the platform, like all sorts of perks and advantages.
Right. You write somewhere in the book that Spotify has always claimed that they're leveling the playing field for musicians that maybe aren't big stars, they'll get a better shot at finding an audience and promoting their music. But you point out that it's very difficult to level the playing field when all of the power and influence in the arrangements and in the contracts are resident in those three major labels.
Yeah, and it's hard to imagine a level playing field with a system where so many, most artists will never get the ability to review the contracts that dictate the terms of not just Spotify, but like streaming services in general, both the contracts that exist between the major labels and streaming services, but also other rights holders and streaming services, like even the contract that dictates their relationship with streaming. They're highly secretive contracts governed by NDAs. There's so much opacity and secrecy. So a lot of independent artists and unions and advocacy groups have talked about how this sort of culture of secrecy around what's actually in the contracts that dictate the terms under which artists are operating is one of the core issues of this whole era in recorded music. And I think it's kind of an important thing to sort of ground a conversation in Spotify with, so much of, from my perspective, so much of what first interested me in writing about this company was kind of like pushing back on this sort of narrative that streaming services were contributing to the democratization of culture. And I feel like it's kind of powerful mythology that in some ways continues today when you hear people talk about this person became this famous artist just because their music went viral on streaming services or viral on TikTok because people really liked it. It's like, no, there's so many other things that influence popularity in the platform economy beyond just kind of like, what becomes popular being the will of the people or something. And yeah, like remembering the reality of those actual contracts that dictate these platforms is one good starting point, I think.
Okay, so like you say, I think this is a good, important grounding for any conversation about Spotify to understand who the players are and where power resides. This is a company that, as you say, from the very beginning was making close partnerships with the three major labels. They wrote NDAs to keep artists in the dark about what their contracts actually said. And those power arrangements are maintained to this day. So Spotify never was and isn't and never will be a scrappy startup that's leveling the playing field for indies somehow. I thought you had a nice way of putting this. You wrote, "These were the people for whom streaming was made by and for: major label execs, consultants, ad men, and venture capitalists, all working to get their own share of the pie." And I noticed, Liz, in that list of beneficiaries of the streaming model, I didn't hear any mention of musicians or artists, let alone listeners.
Yeah. And, there's lots of reasons for that. But in a really basic sense, to just the reality that streaming services don't pay artists directly. Like, actually, a company like Spotify, just a week or so ago, released its annual streaming economics report where it talks about all of the money that it has passed along to the music business in the past year. And it's always an interesting moment when those numbers come out to see how different people in the music industry respond. Like, it seems like this year there's other companies that have been scrambling to also like offer some quote unquote transparency about how much money they're passing along to artists. But none of these streaming services can actually tell you very much meaningful information about what artists make because they pay rights holders, not musicians. They make payments to the major labels that they have deals with. They make a big payment to the Merlin Group, which represents thousands of independent record labels. They make payments to the DIY distributors like TuneCore and CD Baby. But all of those companies maintain the contracts with artists, and they in turn then pass along royalties to artists per the contracts that they have with them. So there's not even really much that Spotify can tell you about how much artists are getting paid. I mean, you'll even see in their own streaming economics reports, they're always very careful to talk about the amount of money generated by certain artists. They don't actually say, this is how much money we paid this artist. We say, this is how much money this artist generated, because all they know is what they're passing along to the rights holders. And then the rights holders dictate the rest of the relationship. There's so many levels of abstraction to how payment works in the streaming era.
Even so, Spotify knows quite well that most of the artists whose songs are on the platform are not being paid very much. You have a chapter title that I liked a lot. The first 0.0035 is the hardest, which is to say, you know, the first third of a penny is the hardest, which in a way is literally true because of a relatively new royalty structure that Spotify announced, that tracks getting less than 1,000 plays per year were going to be totally demonetized. And that represents something upwards of 85% of the tracks on Spotify. So now, granted, some of those tracks are just, you know, noise or people goofing off or whatever and uploading nonsense. But as you point out, a lot of the tracks that have been demonetized, meaning the artists are getting zero, are legitimate songs or libraries of songs. You talk about the Smithsonian Folkways collection. They're in that 86% that are not making any money anymore. Is that right?
Yeah. So a few things. One, the chapter title, shout out to John Giovanni Records, because that chapter title's deeply inspired by something that they tweeted once. And I was grateful to be able to title the chapter after that joke that Joe Steinhardt made on Twitter once. Another thing that I think is worth pointing out too is that that new royalty model that the music business has started calling artist-centric, that involved the demonetization of tracks, of 1,000 tracks or less per year, was essentially created by Universal Music Group. And I think it's a really good example of how these secret contracts that exist between major record labels and streaming services continue to have implications and consequences for the whole of music. So in the book, I reference this article in the Financial Times from a few years ago that talked about how, you know, when Universal Music Group in recent years, like when its negotiations with Spotify came up, there was one round of negotiating where it made the adoption of this so-called artist-centric model a requirement of their new deal together. So it's just like another example of how much influence the majors really do sort of have over the entire model. And then, yeah, to what you were saying, one of the labels that I spoke with for this chapter was Smithsonian Folkways, who talked about, you know, how this new royalty scheme or this new policy of demonetizing tracks with 1,000 streams or fewer was sort of presented as a way of fighting fraud, fighting scammers, fighting like people who are uploading large volumes of AI nonsense to the platform, but seem to just throw in a lot of like independent music or so-called like music by amateurs and hobbyists, which is a couple of words that they like to sort of like throw around as well to sort of delegitimize anyone who's not like a super professionalized or mainstream musician and has all of its own problematic implications that come with it. I mean, personally, I don't think that the CEO of Universal Music Group should get to decide like who is a serious artist and who is a so-called amateur or hobbyist, or also that like being an amateur or a hobbyist is a bad thing. It means that you deserve like no compensation for your music being streamed by a commercial service. I mean, even people who are amateurs and hobbyists, like I think would like for their music to not be utterly exploited by streaming and major label executives for the benefit of their own catalogs. But yeah, something really interesting that came up with the conversation with Smithsonian Folkways too is like, you know, we were talking specifically about how this artist-centric model, in addition to demonetizing tracks with 1,000 streams or fewer, one of the other sort of terms of this change in the royalty system is that it also aims to demonetize anything that is perceived as a noise or a nature sound, so like non-musical noise content. And something that's really interesting is that in the Smithsonian catalog, there is a lot of music or a lot of recordings that have been, you know, deemed non-music noise content because they have all these archival things like, you know, the sounds of North American frogs or like these archival recordings on records like Sounds of the Office is like one of them, you know, and how these are surely not records that Smithsonian ever plans to like get rich off of or anything, but they're also really interesting, important records in their catalog and ones that listeners and fans of their label have, you know, really enjoyed over the years. They're important parts of their broader catalog. And that part of their perception of the problem with this new royalty model wasn't even necessarily just like the demonetization of these tracks, but also just how having them grouped in with like spammers and fraudsters makes it harder for them to be responsible stewards of their archive. And like, it makes it harder for them to sort of fulfill their mission or like obligation as a label with like an educational mission when the material that they have in their catalog is just sort of like, yeah, deemed spammy noise content by this broader arrangement.
Yeah, so we have three major labels, Universal, Sony, and Warner. And if you're signed with one of those three labels, all of a sudden you're legitimate and you are likely to be monetized on the Spotify platform. But if you're not one of those three labels, well, there's a good chance you might be amateur, hobbyist, fraudster, spammer. We're going to put them all in this wasteland out there. Again, another indication that it's this oligopoly that is calling the shots within Spotify. And the result of that is, as you quote someone saying in the book, major label superstars tend to derive the bulk of the revenues. Which makes sense. I mean, there's something called the power law distribution in a lot of online platforms where there's just a handful of superstars that derive most of the financial reward. And then there's maybe a tiny little middle class of people who get something equivalent to a living wage, not very many of them. And then an enormously long tail of people who get almost nothing. And that represents the vast majority of musicians whose work is on Spotify. And fine, you know, Spotify is a corporate service. There are major label superstars who are getting paid a lot. Good for them. The problem is that Spotify has eaten the music industry, or I should say Spotify and these major label partners together have eaten the music industry. And you write a chapter and more about the plight of independent artists outside of those three major labels who are having trouble making ends meet because there simply are not that many alternatives to playing by Spotify's rules now.
Yeah. And I think also something that's super interesting is just like the way in which this really specific way of thinking about value, which is like the per stream valuation of music, that might work well for pop stars or people who are generating mass amounts of streams, but the per stream valuation of music is so much less sustainable for people making more experimental music or challenging music or music that just, you know, might have a lot of value to someone who's willing to kind of like buy it directly or go see it live or, you know, listen to it in certain contexts, but it's not the kind of music you want to like leave on play in the background all day. And I feel like that's sort of another kind of issue of this whole system.
Well, we've established the big corporate nature of Spotify. We've established that the artists who align themselves closely with those big corporations have the best chance of doing well. And then, as you brought up, Spotify has this calculation of value in terms of the number of streams of a given song, which is totally inappropriate for many types of music and many artists. And you quote at one point Darius von Armon, co-founder of the independent label group Secretly Group, who said, quote, "It's not sustainable to put out challenging records. To be sustainable, you have to put out records that are going to get repeat listens in coffee shops." And now we're beginning to get a sense of how Spotify is molding the music industry and beyond that, the culture of music at large, in that it's looking for tracks that are going to be popular to be played again and again and again. And this brings up now the kind of music, or to use Spotify's wonderful word, the kind of content that Spotify is tuned to reward. And it's something that you write quite a bit in this book about called lean back music. And you also talk about functional music. Can you describe what do those terms mean for people who haven't heard it? What's lean back music and what's functional music?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting how in so many of my interviews, the concept of music that would do well in the background of a coffee shop came up. I was like, wow, like there's like a whole subplot of this book that involves coffee shops. And it's so interesting to me because not only are musicians being pressured to make music that could play well in the background of a coffee shop, but so many musicians also end up working in coffee shops because of, like, the precarious nature of creative labor. So many, I feel like every coffee shop I go to in Brooklyn, there's somebody who's in a band working there. So anyway, I just thought that was super interesting. So chapter three of the book is called Selling Lean Back Listening. And yeah, it's about the rise of this idea in the streaming era of lean back listening, the listener who is less interested in going and searching for an artist or an album and is more content to hit play on a specific playlist or a mood or a vibe and just sort of either let the playlist play in the background or let Spotify decide or any streaming service. Spotify didn't invent the idea of lean back listening. In some ways, you could think of the history of commercial radio as sort of a history of lean back listening or passive listening. And then functional music would be a subcategory of lean back listening or passive listening, which is, this word that the industry uses to describe music for studying, sleeping, working out, meditating, chill out music. Obviously, there's also all sorts of prehistories for thinking about this type of music as well. But something that I talk about in the book is how, this phrase functional music is also the word that was used historically by Muzak to describe its product offering as well, especially in the years when Muzak, which was initially sort of developed as a way of piping channels of music into people's homes, when their product offering shifted more to music for productivity for offices and factories, or music for shopping malls. That's kind of like when they started characterizing what they did as functional music.
Yeah, I appreciated how you contextualized functional music and Muzak. I mean, all the way back to Edison. I didn't realize that that approach had reached back that far. I remember when I was growing up in the 1980s, we all made fun of Muzak because when you would walk through a shopping mall, just as you said, there would be this horribly generic pseudo music piped through the PA system of the store. Just gross, you know? But the difference, I think, is that back then, I guess it was the Muzak Corporation that was serving up that glop for stores. That company did not own the music industry. You know, it was just when you went to a store, you'd hear that kind of stuff. But now you have Spotify, which, as we've said, is incredibly influential in the music industry and for music listening everywhere. And it has adopted this lean back approach as something that it wants to optimize for because, as you said, people listening to this musical glop in the background, they're unlikely to turn it off. And so that gives them all the metrics they're looking for. I want to read a couple of sentences you wrote that I think got at this well. You wrote, "It feels fitting that Spotify was originally imagined as an advertising platform because, in many cases, when you press play on a calm down, wellness vibes, or whatever mood playlist, what you're hearing is something that was cranked out by someone making music for an advertising library. It makes sense that as the digital world has grown to feel more like a shopping mall, it is also sometimes the very companies making music for shopping malls that are flooding its soundtrack." And so the generic and mediocre and disappointing sounds of Muzak are now the soundtrack of the internet. And you actually go even deeper by talking to some of the musicians that are hired on contract to make these songs. Maybe you can talk about that. You write about them as ghost artists. This is the term that's applied to these musicians. What did you learn talking to musicians describing what they called their Spotify playlist gigs?
Yeah, it's super interesting. In that sentence that you just read, and thanks for pulling out that quote, I was specifically sort of referring back to this company called Epidemic Sound, which is a company that It's essentially like a production music library. It's a Swedish company. They commission composers and musicians to make mass amounts of background music that they can offer as a royalty-free library to, for example, like YouTubers or people who work in the media who need some background music to play underneath, like a monologue or something, and they want it in a royalty-free way. So they commission musicians to make this music, buy out certain rights. People working for Epidemic Sound are required to resign from their PROs. So, like, they can't be represented by this certain type of organization that collects certain types of royalties for musicians. And then, almost a decade ago at this point, people in the music business trade press and people on social media noticed that a lot of these Epidemic Sound tracks were appearing in really popular Spotify playlists. And it seemed like there must have been some sort of, deal in place or some sort of relationship there, because oftentimes around the mid 2010s, when you went searching for example, like a study playlist on Spotify, you would end up on this official Spotify playlist that was, almost entirely tracks from Epidemic Sound and other similar sort of production music libraries. There's all sorts of different speculation on why this might have been over the years. People started calling them fake artists. In 2022, this one Swedish newspaper, DN, did some more research on this. They were able to track down some copyright documents and started sort of digging into this and seeing, oh, yeah, there's this group, this really small group of Swedish songwriters who are responsible for hundreds of artist monikers and thousands of tracks across this platform that are being added to these official first-party Spotify playlists, but they refer to you as editorial playlists. But there's not a lot of like transparency around what's going on. And internally, this material at Spotify is referred to as perfect fit content, and the description is music commissioned for certain moods and playlists with improved margins. So you know that there's some sort of cost-saving deal going on there. The reason why I refer to it as ghost music or ghost artists is because while I was reporting this out, it was a time when a lot of people were having a lot of conversations about generative AI music and the potential consequences of streaming services being flooded with generative AI content. And I wanted to make sure there was a distinction there, that at least in my research, what I found was more of this practice of the streaming services having deals with these production companies who then were commissioning musicians to make this work in bulk under special deal terms. And it wasn't necessarily specifically generative AI made, but there definitely seems to be, some sort of slippery slope here. It's not hard to imagine these companies that Spotify is licensing PFC from just turning to generative AI to make it, and even Epidemic Sound, like in their own press materials and their own annual reports and stuff, have talked about being excited about the potential of generative AI for the people that they work with too. So
and we're back. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are a little more than halfway through my interview with Liz Pelly, author of the new book, Mood Machine: The Rise of Spotify and the Costs of the Perfect Playlist. If you'd like a link to the book and some other items, go to the playlist at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. Let's go ahead now and listen to part two of my interview with Liz Pelly here on Tectonic. I love some of the quotes you got from the PFC musicians. You write about, quote, making PFC jazz. They had agreed to talk to me about what they called their Spotify playlist gig, a commitment they also called brain-numbing and pretty much completely joyless. Quote, you knock out like 15 in an hour or two. I think that was 15 songs. And the most common feedback they got, play simpler. Be as milquetoast as possible and keep it short. So I read this and I have empathy for these artists who are trying to get work any way they can. And this is paid work. They have to sign away their rights. They know they're being exploited, but, you know, it's, I guess it's that or more hours at the coffee shop. And so they're doing what they have to do. So I don't fault the musicians at all. But as you say, the structure, whether we're looking at Epidemic Sound or Spotify, the structure is these companies are looking for more and more cost savings. And exploiting musicians is one way to do that. But as you say, Liz, it just seems logical that the next step would be to cut out human interaction almost entirely and to just press generate on a Gen AI music tool somewhere. It sounds like you don't have any evidence that this is happening yet, but are there indications that Spotify is moving towards Gen AI music and its library?
Well, I definitely, you know, I don't think any of the services have any sort of rules currently about not allowing generative AI music. You know, like there's certainly a big topic of conversation in the music industry right now is how streaming services are being flooded with generative AI music. And what remains to be seen is sort of like more these companies making policies about how they're going to be treating this material. Because, yeah, you know, in the book, I talk about different generative AI music companies like Boomy and Endel that have music that is going onto streaming services every day. You know, it's, I think what remains to be seen is whether or not the streaming companies are going to treat this content differently than music made by artists. You know, is it going to be labeled? Like if a track is like entirely generative AI, should there be a way that the user knows that? If a company is paying lower royalty rate on a track because of some sort of deal with a company that's making generative AI music, like, should that be made explicit to the listener? Like, I think it should. I think it's kind of a similar thing that comes up in the conversations around the ghost artist stuff. Like, ever since I published this article, some people have kind of like sent me links being like, hey, can you let me know if this is a real artist or a fake artist? And I just feel like that should never be a question that anyone has, you know, like it should be labeled in some way. And I think it's similar with generative AI music. So yeah, there's the same sort of conversations around like, how will we make sure that like, there's not like mass deception of listeners happening? And then how do we make sure that artists' compensation isn't just being driven down for artists through these practices? It sort of raises some similar issues, regardless of like, whether it's artists, musicians being commissioned at a really low rate, or if it's being made with generative AI. And they both also bring up the maybe more important existential issue, which is that like, both the ghost artist phenomenon and the use of generative AI music both sort of work to just cut out artists entirely in a lot of ways. Even just to suggest that people could be content to like just hit play on a certain mood or vibe button and then just get like an endless stream of content, that also is an interaction that really like cuts out the role of the artist to like whether it's musicians making the music or an AI system making the music, it diminishes the role of the artist.
Yeah, when you say that it's possible artists could get cut out, or it's possible that Spotify could be deceptive in not labeling, you know, tracks as to their provenance, I'm thinking you're being so polite, Liz, because Mood Machine shows that a lot of these practices are already in place at Spotify. There was one section where you write about, I just love this, that there was a group of Spotify employees who self-organized something they called the Ethics Club, where they would talk about the ethics of what Spotify was doing. If I remember right, one of their topics was, shouldn't we be labeling some of these tracks a little bit better if they are this so-called PFC perfect fit content that's coming from these stock libraries, so that we're not deceiving users as to who's an actual band or if that's their actual artist name, rather than one of a thousand made up names that were invented. And I mean, they asked the question, but it never went anywhere, to my knowledge. Maybe I'm cynical, but I see it as inevitable that Spotify is going to reach for Gen AI music and increase their margins that much more. And are they going to label it to Spotify users that no humans were involved in making this? Of course not. They're going to make up a fake artist name and list it in their one-size-fit-all approach, ride alongside other artists who have been working their entire lives to hone their craft and to write and perform these songs and are getting paid $0.0035 per stream. It's disappointing to feel this cynical about this incredibly influential company, but that's how I feel about just about every influential tech company these days.
Yeah. I think you're right too, in that none of these sort of changes, like the idea of streaming service being required to label when material is made by generative AI or when it's being serviced to a user because of some sort of pre-existing commercial deal that's not being made explicit. It's like no one's ever just going to like volunteer that information. I think that's kind of like something that either has to come from public pressure or policy change. You know, like I think in a lot of cases, these tech companies have to be made to change that. They're not just going to like do it out of the kindness of their hearts because they're concerned with like listeners not being deceived. It's something that would have to come from some sort of outside pressure, I think.
I want to talk a little bit about the effects of Spotify on the listeners. We've referred tangentially to one of those effects, which is the disconnect between listeners and the artists. As you said, Spotify's goal is for someone to hit play and not worry about who the artists are, just lean back and listen to the music. Beyond that severing of the listener's relationship with the musicians, there's another aspect of Spotify's effects on listeners that I wanted to bring up. And you have a whole chapter on this, which is about Spotify's surveillance of users. Mm. This chapter is called Streaming as Surveillance. You start by quoting a former Spotify machine learning engineer who says the following: every click that you've made in the app, speaking of the Spotify app, has been logged somewhere. You should be under the assumption that any interaction you have within the Spotify app is going to be recorded. And here, Liz, is yet another reality of how Spotify works that they're not going out of their way to make clear to their users. Furthermore, you write that Spotify has partnered with Facebook, Uber, Tesla, Tinder, as well as Ancestry.com and my favorite DNA surveillance company, 23andMe. So here's a company that is not only engaged in surveillance, but is partnering with data brokers and other surveillance capitalists. So it's very much part of the surveillance blob that I talk about a lot on this show. How should we think about Spotify's surveillance activities, Liz? Is this just a little side detail, or is this something important to Spotify's model?
Yeah, something that is really funny is that there even is a chapter of this book called Streaming as Surveillance. And I thought about this while writing, because in some ways, like the whole book is about streaming as surveillance, but I thought it was important to have a specific chapter that's directly about data collection, the ways in which Spotify sort of like engaged in the broader marketplace of data brokerage, and also how it informs their advertising business, and just sort of like some of these broader consequences for listeners, or like the importance of when we think about Spotify, not just thinking of it as like a music company or a tech company, but like specifically thinking of it through this lens as a participant or like as part of the broader story of surveillance capitalism. I think that it is important because in a lot of ways, like when you talk about music, something that for years and years and years and years, I feel like I have observed is, you know, when you start talking about Spotify's collection of data, or you even see this like every year around the Wrapped campaign where people are sharing these stats about their music listening that are based on all this data that's being collected about them, there's this sort of deep sense of ambivalence, like, oh, well, yeah, they have a lot of data on me, but it's just music. Or yeah, they have a lot of data on me, but it helps them make more pointed recommendations. So it's data collection for good. You know, like I actually have heard people say that over the years. And I think that, you know, there's a bunch of things that I bring up in the book through, this is a section of the book that I'm really grateful to the various people who I've spoke with or like referenced in this chapter. There's like a GDPR lawyer who I spoke with who was involved in bringing a lawsuit against the Swedish Data Protection Authority for not enforcing GDPR policy that ended in Spotify being fined like millions of dollars for not complying with this law. I reference the work of Eric Draught, this professor at UT Austin, who writes about music as a technology of surveillance in his book, Streaming Music, Streaming Capital. And there's, yeah, just like other references made throughout that chapter that help tell this whole story of all the reasons why it's important to not just think of the data that Spotify has on you as one, just data that only lives with Spotify. Like, you know, all of these platforms are engaged in practices of sharing data with data brokers, sort of syncing up your streaming data with data they have from you from other platforms to sort of paint this bigger picture of you as a internet user or consumer. And then also this idea that it's just music or it's being used for recommendation, I think also isn't really true to the role that data collection plays in these businesses, where there's lots of different reasons why they collect all this data. Like, it strengthens their product. It allows them to sell ads more effectively, but then also the data itself becomes like this own commodity in and of itself that they're able to kind of package and sell like in the broader data marketplace. And yeah, there's all sorts of, you know, implications of this.
Yeah, you're right that people's data that is gathered by Spotify surveillance activities can be passed to credit agencies, banks, healthcare providers, insurers, governmental agencies, and finance companies. So this is not just about what tracks you listen to that then gets put in a social media ready wrapped post or something, which, by the way, is all about Spotify getting customers to advertise Spotify even more. People are being manipulated into just doing free advertising for Spotify. The whole thing is rotten. I don't know what other word to use for it.
I also clarify too, like those types of entities that might end up like with your data as a result of your stream behavior, and like kind of speaking more broadly about like types of companies that might turn to music data. Like, I'm not like specifically saying Spotify definitely shares your data with these types of companies, but like to speak more broadly about types of places that do have in the past looked for music data. You know, it's worth considering, and I think that it is fair to assume that various data that is collected on you due to your engagement with music like could be used for these types of purposes.
Yeah, thank you. That's a good clarification. That's totally fair. You're right that Spotify is a partner of Axiom, one of the world's largest data brokers. And so people's data, to be clear, is going to Axiom or its other partners that I listed before. And then it's up to Axiom or whatever partner if and who to share that data with. And so it may or may not be your bank or your health insurer. But we know from the activities of other companies that I've covered on the show that engage in surveillance, that that data can find its way to all sorts of other places. But you're right, Liz, to clarify my statement there. We don't know that Spotify data is going to those places. But anyway, that's how it works. Before we wrap, Liz, I wanted to talk about solutions. And I thought you did an excellent job in this book in pointing to two avenues of possible hope for listeners. And those two avenues are the individual response and the collective response. On the collective side, there are some efforts like United Musicians and Allied Workers, or UMAW, that was co-founded by Damon Krukowski, who's a past guest on this show. It was founded in 2020. There's also the MWA, the Music Workers Alliance. And those groups are doing a great job in trying to envision some legislation that might begin to right some of the wrongs of Spotify and these major labels. What can you tell us about their progress so far?
Yeah. So in the book, I specifically spend a pretty decent amount of time tracking the emergence of this thing called the Living Wage for Musicians Act. It's this bill that members of UMA wrote together with Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib's office. And it was introduced last year, I believe it was introduced. One of the reasons why I wanted to tell the story of this bill is because I think it's such an interesting example of group of self-organized, scrappy DIY musicians start meeting on Zoom during the, you know, peak pandemic era to put their heads together and, you know, share their experiences and talk about trying to engage in some sort of collective action around the state of the music industry. And then just a few years later, they're working with a sitting US Congresswoman to introduce a bill. And like, I think that's to go back and just ask, like, how did that happen? I think is a really interesting question and really sort of in some ways like illuminates the work of grassroots organizing and the power of it. So tracing all of those details, you know, hopefully helped to kind of like paint a picture of how that bill came to be. To me, like what's most interesting about it is like the story of the campaign more broadly and the ways in which it could be used as an organizing tool almost more than the legislation itself. Although I do think the legislation itself is interesting. It presents this idea of creating a new royalty stream that would go around the rights holders entirely and pay a royalty directly to musicians. And I think that would be not only really meaningful, but I think it's interesting that it's rooted in pre-existing laws around digital radio that already exists. So there's like a historical precedent for it as well.
And then we get to our individual response. Here, I thought you did a great job of expressing your love for music and encouraging all of us to support the culture that we want to see in the world. There's one part where you're addressing the person who says, well, I'll switch from buying records to streaming because, you know, the artist will probably get paid from the streaming royalties instead. And you write, quote, even one person switching to streaming from buying a record more than cancels out however many people might algorithmically stream the song. So basically you're saying, if you want to support the musicians, go and see them perform or go and buy their record, because then at least you know they're going to get paid.
Yeah, actually, you know, that quote, that was something that came from like an interview that I did with someone who works at an independent record label too, which I think is even more interesting because it's actually someone working at an independent record label that's coming from someone who looks at the balance sheet. It's just like actually one person switching to streaming can make a really big difference for our bottom lines. It's really important for people to buy records. And yeah, something I talk about towards the end of the book is how in the face of such enormous systemic issues, it can feel really surface level to talk about individual responsibility. And I really don't like that being centered as such an important part of thinking about the sustainability of culture. But there is a role that like each of us does play in contributing to strengthening the cultural ecosystems that we want to exist in the world. Like you just said, you know, at a certain point, it's like, when you think about streaming services, they over the past 20 years have been sort of like pitched as these sort of replacements for, on one hand, like radio, and on the other hand, the record store. These are sort of like ways in which streaming has been sort of like framed as like, oh, like, you know, well, isn't it just like radio, or like, you know, or that this is where people are going to go to like spend their $10 a month to financially kind of invest in music or to spend money on music. So if you think about it through those two terms, it's like, well, if you what you care about is independent music, then I think that the most direct way of contributing to strengthening the independent music ecosystems is by turning to instead, you know, independent media ecosystems and independent music retail instead of these giant consolidated corporate media companies. But I do think that supporting independent community radio and independent music media is a really important piece of the like broader puzzle of thinking about alternatives to streaming. And I really think we've seen that in recent years too. Like, I do think there's a lot of people who are like thinking about the importance of independent radio, community radio, and online radio, like in the context of it offering an alternative to streaming too, and like remembering that these like streaming services are absolutely no replacement for the role that independent media plays in music.
That's right. I like how you put this. Music is too important to be left solely to the marketplace. We have to validate the culture we want to see in the world. And you have pointed away, both individually and collectively, Liz, in how we can together start building a better culture by resisting the predations of Spotify and its corporate partners. I thought this was an outstanding book. Liz, thank you for doing all of the research and reporting you've done over so many years and bringing it all together in this book. I recommend it to all Tectonic listeners. It's called Mood Machine: The Rise of Spotify and the Costs of the Perfect Playlist. Liz Pelley, thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host for the remaining few minutes of the show. We just heard my interview with Liz Pelley talking about her new book, Mood Machine: The Rise of Spotify and the Costs of the Perfect Playlist. It's just out by Simon & Schuster. And if you would like a link to the book, on the Tectonic playlists, I always post links to books using Bookshop. I never use the Monopoly named after a river. You can find the Bookshop link to Mood Machine if you go to the playlist, which is at the Tectonic website, tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. Find the Liz Pelley episode, click the playlist link, and there it is. Also on that page, you'll note that I have a couple of excerpts of writing by Damon Krukowski. He used to be with Galaxy 500. Now he's with Damon and Naomi, and has been on the show a couple of times, a friend of the show. I'm a fan of Damon's music and his writing. And he has a blog on Substack. I'm not a fan of Substack, but beyond that, I am a fan of what Damon writes within his blog. It's called Data Drummer. And he has written about Liz Pelley's work a number of times, and his work at Yuma, which we mentioned during the interview. Damon was one of the co-founders of Yuma. But I just wanted to read an excerpt. This is from a post by Damon on February 3rd, 2025, and the post is called Active Listening, Jen and Liz Pelley. It's a kind of a profile of Liz Pelley and her sister Jen. And here's what Damon writes about this book. Liz Pelley's new book, Mood Machine, is a thoroughly researched, superbly written takedown of Spotify's privatization of audio space. The technology of streaming, quote, was going to level the playing field for artists, Spotify obsessively promised, writes Liz. What we actually got, though, were playlists heavily dominated by major label acts, endless feeds of neo-Muzak loaded with ghost artists, anonymous stock music commissioned at a discount, and a series of pay-to-play schemes, unquote. Damon continues, Mood Machine dissects each of these moves by Spotify, aided by the major label oligopoly of Universal, Sony, and Warner, laying bare the anti-musical motivations of its founders and investors. I thought that was a really accurate and well-written summary of this book, and I'm happy as I'm reading this to see that Liz and I touched on just about all those points. We didn't get into the pay-to-play schemes, the so-called digital payola that is rife on Spotify. You're going to have to read Mood Machine for yourself to learn the details of that little scam. That is about all the time I have this evening. I hope you found this interview enlightening and helpful. You know what? Let me just take one other minute, because I want to read just one or two sentences from Damon's other post. This is from March 17, 2025. The headline, Spotify is a microcosm of billionaire BS. And Damon writes, Spotify paid billions to rights holders in 2024, and recording artists received none of that directly by careful design. Damon's writing about how artists receive their tiny little share through record labels. And Damon writes, it's typically 15% of 1/3 of a penny per stream. That is 0.00045 a stream, that's dollars, less recoupable expenses, which in practice often means zero. I have friends, he writes, with millions of streams on Spotify in 2024 and nothing, financially speaking, to show for it. So I hope this interview, these excerpts, if you read the book, I hope these resources will help explain to you why I am not a fan of Spotify. And of course, I am a fan of independent radio, WFMU. And now I am out of time. I hope you have found this helpful, friends. I do have some homework for you for next time. I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. You are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, and online at WFMU.org. And for our outro this evening, I thought we would go with a well-chosen track by an artist named Cadence Weapon, who comes up a couple of times in Liz Pelly's book. And I'm a fan of Cadence Weapon. Here is Cadence's track, which is called My Computer. Have a great week, everybody. See you next time.
So I always saw Rolly on the computer. He was always on the computer.
Hey now, Welcome to another episode, another installment of It's Complicated, an hour of prog and prog-adjacent music. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. I'm here every Monday bringing you this program, Monday evening, 7 to 8, Eastern Time. Thank you so much for joining me. A pleasure. It's always a pleasure to be here playing music for these 60 minutes. And we're going to start tonight's show with a track from a group called Pollen. They were based in French Canada, not just Canada, but French Canada, and in the mid-70s. In fact, they only put out one album, as far as I know, and we're going to hear it, or we're going to hear a track from it. One claim to fame that this band has, and it is a claim to fame, it's something that I would tell my grandchildren about, certainly, is that they toured with Gentle Giant in the 70s. Anyway, their only album was a self-titled one, came out in 1976, Pollen, and we're going to hear a track with a long French title that I will tell you more about some other time, but this is Pollen.
S'effondre. L'histoire maquillée se meurt. Les curés, les évêques sont venus crier. Sous prétexte d'amour, ils nous ont trompés. Pardonnez-nous, on a payé. Même en voulant crier.
Au fond.